Our next case is McDonald against Household International. Mr. Kehoe. You may be the only lawyer in the room who doesn't know what this Booker stuff is that we're talking about.
It was entertaining. And you're correct, I do.
Again,
not.
Again, there's a switch under the lower right if you want to raise the podium.
I think it's fine. Thank you, sir.
No one wants to.
I'm counsel for appellant McDonald, whose complaint was dismissed at the district court level under an 1132 ERISA preemption analysis. What we're asking for in our de novo review today is for this court to engage in the 1144 conflict analysis and going beyond what has been characterized as unhelpful text, getting to the very underpinning policy issues supporting ERISA and the entire a conflict preemption issue.
Mr. Kehoe, I have a very fundamental question to ask you, though. This case, of course, is dismissed on the pleadings, 12b-6. And, you know, I learned in law school that people don't plead law anyway. They plead in federal courts enough to give the opponent notice of what you're complaining about. And yet, lots of back and forth happened in this case, and you didn't change your complaint to put ERISA into it and so forth, and I'm less worried about that. I'm trying to understand what is happening kind of underneath it all, because if, for example, the facts that you have recounted in your complaint are better characterized as a benefits claim or an ERISA kind of claim, it strikes me that what's really affected is the remedy, whether it's, you know, return of premiums paid or whether it's I can't tell from what you've said. It looks to me from your complaint as though you're saying that he did not receive payments under this medical plan for whatever treatment he had when he suffered his stroke. I don't know, but that's what the complaint looks like to me. But I can't figure out why everybody's off on this. You know, is it a state law theory or is it an ERISA theory, since we're at the pleading stage?
Well, we are at the pleading stage where allegations have to be taken as true. And the essence of the plaintiff.
But the allegations are things happened to this man. You know, he tried to get his prescriptions filled in December and they weren't filled because the pharmacy said you don't have insurance. And then he suffers this stroke in January and he's telling this story, and he's trying to make two parties responsible for it. One, the employer, two, the plan, United Health Care. And whether he can do so under some state law theory, whether he can do so under ERISA, seems to me a question for later, since, as you've pointed out in your brief, there does appear to be complete diversity here, and I don't think anybody has asserted that the kind of medical care he received doesn't meet the amount in controversy, or perhaps it's a federal question if it's an ERISA case.
That's exactly why we think the 1144 analysis has to take place.
But why do we have to get to that? I mean, you know, what you want, as I understand it, is this to be a state tort claim, because if it is a state tort claim, then you at least have some chance of recovering the consequential damages from the failure of the employer to live up to whatever the contract was in this employment letter.
I would agree. It's clearly from McDonald's case.
That's what you want.
It is a consequential damage case. His case is one of breach of contract occurring outside the ERISA plan.
No, I understand that.
That is the heart of his complaint.
Right, and there would be a time for you to argue that, as opposed to taking probably a vastly lesser amount of compensation if it's really a claim for benefits best characterized under.
Could I ask a variation of Judge Wood's question? Is there any remedy that would be available under ERISA, like full reimbursement for all of the medical expenses, that your client has not already received?
in theory, Judge Easterbrook, perhaps McDonald can make them pay for 1 month of his hypertensive medication from which he was denied that led to his hemorrhagic hypertensive stroke.
Did the plan pay for his medical expenses after he had his stroke?
That is not a contested issue in the case.
Did the plan pay for his medical expenses after he had his stroke?
Yes, sir. His medical expenses have been a part covered by the plan and part covered by government benefits.
All right.
Certainly.
So that may be the answer to the question, that there's no extra relief you could get under ERISA, and that's why you're not concerned.
Well, or very small. I mean, maybe not enough to destroy the claim, but a pretty small amount of money.
We don't feel that his employer nor the plan should be divorced from their misconduct that put him in the nursing home and be left to pay for his nursing home expense. We don't find that to be a remedy of any variety. We don't feel it to be recognizing of his breach of contract claim, which we think under an 1144 analysis is valid, which is why we go back to the presumption that hasn't been met, that his claim is preempted.
Right. I guess, again, the procedural posture, in a way, I guess what you're saying is even if it was a mistake to dismiss this claim under 12b-6 because one doesn't have to plead legal theories, the amount that you think he could recover under an ERISA theory is so trivial it's just not worth pursuing the litigation for that. Is that accurate?
It's no remedy. He has no ERISA remedy.
So you agree that, so in a sense, he's willing to waive whatever, little amount of money he could get for that December 19 to January 15
period. The district court gave him an option of pursuing an ERISA remedy, having considered everything else preempted, and that was not pursued. Hence, we're here before you today.
Yeah, well, as my colleague said, the hence is all wrong. We've seen this exact setup before, where the district judge said, well, you pleaded a claim under state law, it's dismissed unless you replead under ERISA. And we said in no uncertain terms, this is what my colleague is referring to, a case called Bartlet against Reischauer AG, that is error from start to scratch. It is a totally incorrect application of Rule 12b-6. But what you're now saying on your feet is that error is not a ground on which you seek reversal because it doesn't make any difference to you. But the whole way in which the parties litigated this case in the district court, the entire basis of the district court's decision, is utterly inconsistent with established Rule 12b-6 premises, because it assumes that one pleads law, and that's just not true. Bartlet, by the way, was exactly this case. It was a rerun. This is a rerun of Bartlet. Bartlet is about state law versus ERISA law. Very disappointing to send these cases out and find the entire bar and bench just ignore them.
Perhaps the focus was also directed because of the Supreme Court Aetna opinion, which certainly caught all lawyers' attention, I'm sure our district court's attention as well, which we also think is instructive to the case. But if the court, again, doesn't want to engage in the 1144 analysis, then they don't want to engage, which is what I was requesting both at the district court level and today, because put most simply, I know of no policy underpinning for ERISA that would be advanced by not permitting McDonald's claim for breach of contract, which occurs outside the context of the plan, which is what the district court did not permit.
Well, let me just make a comment about that aspect of your case, since we've certainly made the other point. Some medical plans are very comprehensive. Other medical plans are much more limited, and particularly in this era of skyrocketing costs, lots of employers are cutting back on what they're offering in terms of these kinds of plans. And I don't see how you can avoid ERISA in the sense that household could have even after they hired Mr. McDonald, could have changed their plan. And if the plan they put in place on December the 19th had been one that had absolutely no prescription drug coverage, they would have been utterly within their rights. They would have complied with what they promised to do in the letter, which was to give you whatever medical insurance it is we happen to have. There's nothing in the letter, per se, and you probably recall the great flap about whether prescription drugs are going to be covered under Medicare. I mean, we know that this is, sometimes it's in, sometimes it's out. And I guess I'm having trouble seeing where the promise that you particularly rely on of prescription drug coverage comes from.
Well, it comes from knowledge of the plan.
It happens to be in the
it.
I know it did as it happens, but ex ante, as of the day he's hired, he had no guarantee that as of the 19th there would be prescription drug coverage. All he had a guarantee of is we'll give you whatever we have.
But he did have knowledge of the plan. He did have a contractual representation.
But why does that make any difference? That makes it a benefits claim.
Because it induced him to accept employment. That's the difference. That's the distinction, which takes us back to Irwin versus U-Haul. It takes us back to Smith versus Cohen, where there were inducements for one to accept employment.
But you're saying that if they had changed the plan perfectly legitimately, as sponsors of plans can do, as you well know, under ERISA, between the time they hired him and the time he, you know, his right to the insurance vested, that would have violated something. I don't see that it would have.
Then he would have been free to accept other employment, too.
No, he was free on the 19th of December to do that. I presume, actually.
He did not, Your Honor, because he was induced to accept that employment because he knew he wanted his medication, he knew he wanted health insurance, and this was important to him. He was a sole businessman who lost his business. He had no money, he had no health insurance for himself and his family, and he wanted it, and he was induced to accept that employment just as Irwin and Smith and Cohen were induced to accept their employment, which is why he has a valid contract claim existing outside of the plan, which merely in an incredibly cursory fashion touches upon a plan itself.
Well, I mean, it's sort of centrally does in the sense that he wouldn't be interested in this plan but for the fact that it has prescription drug coverage in it.
And that's the only, you know, that's the only examination of the plan. Does it or does it not have coverage? It's not contested that it did. I mean, it's counterfactual to try to come up with scenarios that did not exist and did not induce him to accept that employment.
Okay.
I'll reserve.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, counsel. Mr. Blessing.
Thank you, Your Honors. My name is Tom Blessing. I represent the Appalachian United Healthcare. The district court's dismissal of the claims against my client was premised upon an analysis of 1132. So I'm going to focus my comments on that, and Mr. Wartell will address Section 1144 in a moment. The claims against United were tort and contract claims for consequential damages arising from a failure to provide benefits, in this case, prescription drug medication. The complaint was pled in such a way as to attempt to assert state law causes of action, breach of contract, negligence, and some other torts, I think willful and wanton misconduct and some other things.
But you know, I'll make the same point, obviously.
Yes.
I'm sure you're expecting it. But you are proceeding as though once you've said ERISA, there's a void. And, of course, that's not true.
Sure.
Once you say ERISA, there is a large federal common law of benefits and of rights and remedies that has evolved over quite a few years by now, and I don't know why you think waving ERISA around is sort of a magic, we're off the hook sort of move to make.
I don't. I suggest that the claims, when they are pled in such a way as to...
Why does the plea... You knew what this was about.
Claims aren't pled under any body of law.
Correct.
Claims are grievances. You say what it was that was wrong, and then the court, under as Rule 54 says, the court will supply the remedy to which the prevailing party is entitled. You don't plead law. There's no, a complaint cannot be dismissed on the theory that it, you know, invokes state law, but it should have invoked federal law, therefore it's dismissed. The only question would be, would ERISA itself have provided no remedy? Otherwise, the complaint can't be dismissed. And we all agree, I take it, that the answer is ERISA would have provided some remedy. Now, maybe not large enough to justify the cost of litigation, as the plaintiff suggests, since
correct,
the plan is apparently paid for the medical costs. But as a legal matter, you can't get a complaint dismissed on this ground. Everything that has happened in this case, everything in the district court, everything in the Court of Appeals, is founded on a misapprehension about how Rule 12b-6 works. All of the argument, almost all of the argument, is totally beside the point.
Well, the facts that were pled in the district court were pled in such a way...
One does not plead facts, either. One pleads claims. We do not have a fact-pleading system in federal court. Sorry.
The Seventh Circuit in particular and the United States Supreme Court have articulated an analysis for when claims such as this are preempted by ERISA. And that is exactly what we have in this situation.
But your problem is that if the state claim is preempted by ERISA, the complaint still can't be dismissed. Because
it just
ERISA
means it's an ERISA.
Provides
In the district court, in its dismissal order, gave plaintiffs leave to amend.
No,
the they
complaint
didn't have to.
Cannot be dismissed. It's not, it must be dismissed, but the plaintiff should be allowed to refile. It cannot be dismissed. There's just no ifs, ands, or buts about that.
So the focus is really, what's the claim under ERISA? You know, is there, if your position, which, you know, I certainly can follow perfectly well, your argument is that this is really a benefits claim, particularly vis-a-vis your client. I mean, you know,
sure,
your client was in the position of providing these benefits, and if it's really a benefits claim, then it arises under ERISA. What does ERISA have to say about the provision of benefits? ERISA allows, as you well know, you know, lawsuits by beneficiaries of plans, and you've argued that Mr. McDonald was, in fact, a beneficiary, even though
the participant,
you know, even though he ran into this bureaucratic difficulty that had such bad consequences. But ERISA does provide, I mean, Congress didn't mean by passing ERISA to destroy the welfare benefit system in the United States. It was trying to shore it up, actually. It was trying
sure.
to create some certainty.
And we've never suggested that there was no remedy under ERISA which he could have availed himself of had he chose to do so. But the way in which he proceeded was to articulate claims which are properly recharacterized.
And what do you think his ERISA remedy is?
Well, that depends upon the time when he asserted it, but he certainly could have, in the month between when he started work and when he had a stroke, he could have purchased this medication on his own and sought reimbursement. That's one thing he could have done. If there was a question of he was being refused for some exclusion under the policy, he could have sought an injunction to require that the benefits be paid pending a determination on his eligibility. So there was a limited window in which he could have had a meaningful remedy under ERISA, but that's sufficient. In other words, the fact that he now effectively, as Mr. Kehoe has acknowledged, doesn't really have a meaningful remedy under ERISA in the sense that he cannot get consequential damages is not the standard. And the Supreme Court has held on many occasions that the fact that preemption results in depriving a claimant of a remedy does not preclude application of 1132. So there was a time in the Aetna case that the standard is if at some point in time the participant, in this case Mr. McDonald, could have brought a claim for denial of benefits, then it is preempted by 1132. Now, you could argue that he can't bring a claim now because it wouldn't do him any good.
He could bring a claim. It's just economics of it may be unfavorable.
Right. That's absolutely right. So we have a situation where he is, I think this court used the term artfully pled
But that's yes. Artful pleading doesn't mean anything if there's no federal jurisdictional problem. I mean, if you try to plead something that makes it look only like a state claim and you're trying to defeat removal or something,
federal,
then,
right.
With
you
diversity,
know,
it's only relevant.
Right. In looking at the parties, you've got a participant suing the plan sponsor, the plan administrator, for denial of benefits. And these relationships among these entities are exactly the sort of situation that ERISA addresses. And for that reason, that is the law which governs his claim, and he should have asserted a remedy. He had a chance in which to amend his complaint to do so. He chose not to. So we have a situation where ERISA completely takes over this field, and the claim should have been dismissed. I see my time has expired. Any other questions? Thank you.
Mr. Wortel.
May it please the Court. Bill Wortel on behalf of Appley's Household Finance Corporation and Household International. As Mr. Blessing mentioned, I'm going to be discussing 1144A preemption, which states that any state law claims that, quote-unquote, relate to an ERISA plan will be preempted. Now, the courts have struggled to define what the phrase relates to means in various contexts. In this particular case, under any definition of that phrase...
You don't want to say under any definition of that phrase. I can come up with definitions of that phrase that will cause you to lose this case in a trice.
Under most...
And of course, as Justice Scalia said in one ERISA case, on the other side, since in a complex world, everything relates to everything else, ERISA preempts all state law, including, say, the state law against murder, because the murder victim might otherwise have had a claim under ERISA.
Right, and I agree.
So one can't say under any definition of that phrase.
Under most definitions of that phrase, it would be held to relate to an ERISA plan, and the reason for that is because it's very clear from the pleadings in this case that plaintiff's claims are all premised on the denial of benefits under an ERISA plan.
But he is making claim, looking at the letter which he's put on page A28, he's making a claim in part that you promised to give him a health insurance policy effective 30 days from his start date, and you didn't. That's his claim. Now, maybe it would be disproven if you showed that somehow you always pay retroactively, you know, to December, you know, to the start date or what have you. I can imagine facts, you know, that might enter into that. But you're I think, a bit mischaracterizing what he's trying to say, which is in part that there is something independent. Now, he would have had to have taken the risk that whatever health insurance you offered up to him didn't have a prescription drug benefit or something, and maybe that would go to the amount of damages recoverable. Again, a kind of an issue for later on down the line. But he's trying to say, you promised me a health insurance policy. You could have done it as an individual policy out there in the market. You could have done it through a plan you operate. I don't really care. You promised me a policy, and you didn't deliver. Why isn't that a breach of contract claim?
I would disagree with the characterization that he's saying you could have given me insurance, any type of insurance. He's very clear from the pleadings that he's claiming that the particular insurance that he's claiming to have been denied was a benefit under the plan, which there are references to throughout the complaint, and he's even attached a summary of the particular plan that he's claiming he was denied benefits under to the complaint. And so it's not a hypothetical situation where there is no plan involved here.
I don't know. We have to ask, is there any set of facts consistent with the complaint? He says the plaintiff was promised insurance coverage, including prescription benefit coverage. So he alleges that you promised him coverage through this plan, and you didn't give him any coverage. Now, he can't say, you know, that you promised never to change the plan or what have you. But he's trying to say, you made me a promise and you didn't come through. My 30 days from my start date rolled around and you were not there.
Well, the problem with this theory that it's a completely independent document separate and apart from the plan is that, you know, this court has held that state law claims will be preempted if they bind employers and plan administrators to a particular choice.
I'm suggesting that there's nothing in this complaint that makes me think that he's trying to do that. Now, at some consequence to what he could recover, I mean, I certainly think, but his complaint says you promised me insurance and, you know, you showed me this plan and you didn't give me anything. It's not like he's not suing because your plan changed or because he failed to read page 35 or, you know, anything like that. We've seen everything. But when you give him nothing instead of what you promised, I don't know why that isn't distinct from the content, the internal content of the plan.
Well, again, I believe there's no way to read this complaint where it clearly attaches a copy of the summary of the plan, says it names the plan by name, and says that he was denied benefits under that particular plan. The offer letter, and if we're going to talk about the offer letter as a separate...
And so what? Let's take a very simple case. The plaintiff, or in my example, the plaintiff's estate, says that the employer offered a welfare benefit plan which included $1 million life insurance policy starting 30 days after it went on the job. On the 31st day, without the policy having been put into force, the plaintiff dies, and his estate says, I'm entitled to $1 million. Isn't that a perfectly good claim under ERISA?
Under ERISA, or is a breach of contract claim based on an independent document?
You have to stop thinking about pleading law. A perfectly good claim, right? Claim is, I was promised this welfare benefit under a plan. It makes me a participant. Therefore, I'm entitled to the benefit that I was promised. Now, ERISA is going to provide that relief, so state law is going to be irrelevant unless one is seeking punitive damages. But your position seems to be that if the employer didn't actually write his name down in the plan, there isn't any remedy at all. And that's
plausible. Your Honor, we've taken the position throughout this that this is an ERISA claim if it's anything. There's no allegation that he's exhausted.
But then if you take the position that it is an ERISA claim, then the complaint can't be dismissed. The complaint could be dismissed only if it's no claim of any kind.
I believe
you asked that the complaint be dismissed, and that's the relief the judge gave you.
Right, and as a practical matter, as Mr. Kehoe said, the plaintiffs have no interest in pursuing this case under ERISA, and there are practical implications as to what claims survive the motion to dismiss. If the district court did not dismiss and allowed it to proceed as an ERISA claim, the case would be dead. And we, as a strategic matter, when you're litigating these cases, obviously, when the consequential damages...
Well, I suppose, one other question. Suppose the state says, we've adopted a general rule. It doesn't relate to health benefits. But our general rule is, if you promise to enter into a contractual relationship as of some date in the future, and you don't keep that promise, you have to pay $1,000 cash in hand. Right? A liquidated damages clause for failing to keep your promise to enter into a contract or to put a contract into force. You think ERISA would preempt that? Does that relate to ERISA plans, or is it a general rule of contract law?
You're saying if the state enacted
a
law
that
said that?
A law of that kind.
When it's applied to an ERISA plan, yes. If it's the subject matter
Why does
of a plan,
that relate to an ERISA plan? Suppose the state adopts a law. I think many states have a law like this.
They do.
It says you need a driver's license to drive a car. And somebody says, well, I don't need a driver's license because all I'm carrying in my car is ERISA plan documents. Does the state law about driver's licenses apply? Or alternatively, could you go 100 miles an hour to get an ERISA plan document from one employer facility to another?
No, but in the hypothetical you've posed, it's going to...
I'm giving you a state law of general applicability, which in a particular application affects an ERISA plan. It's the same with my contract hypothetical and my driver's license and my speed limit hypotheticals. Why would such a state law not be perfectly valid?
Because it would directly impact the administration of ERISA plans.
You have to answer my question that the driver can go 100 miles an hour, because it would directly impact the administration of ERISA plans if you couldn't get documents faster from one place to another.
The way the Supreme Court has been looking at the case, the statutes of general applicability, has been that if the statute only has an indirect economic impact on the ERISA plan, not preempted, doesn't relate to it. With the hypothetical that you're giving, I do believe it would be, because there are going to be a lot of contracts in the employment context are going to be ERISA contracts, and it would directly impact the administration of plans, and there's no way to have uniform administrative policies mm-hmm. under those circumstances.
Okay, thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Kehoe?
Perhaps if the court would decide to address not only the Bartlet issue, but the court's dismissal on the 1132 issue, we can go back and look at Aetna. They misquoted and misapply Aetna. Aetna says if an individual at some point in time could have brought this claim under ERISA and where no other independent legal duty is implicated by defendant's actions, then the individual's cause of action is completely preempted, which is why we talk about having a garden variety breach of contract negligence claim, which arises out of the direct employment letter, which we think is 100% consistent with this court's holding in Biondi, that says, you know, we just shouldn't have garden variety state right issues preempted by federal provisions, ERISA or otherwise, without validly articulated and recognized policy decisions.
Well, you're obviously unaware of Bartlet, but Bartlet says a claim of failure to include me in an ERISA plan is preempted.
I don't think that adversely affects McDonald's cause of action.
Your claim.
To grant the relief that the trial court granted for the defendants creates the very blanket immunity for their misconduct, for their denial of benefit status. Not a benefit, a benefit status is a blanket immunity that our courts have said should not be created. And we're asking this court not to create one as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Mr. Kehoe.
Thank you, Judge.
The case is taken under advisement.